session number 17576, reel 3.
Nigel Walpole, reel 2.
What I'm trying to say here, if you're operating on this basis from different stations over different targets, a competitor might very well go off over a relatively short distance, and his target could be a simple microwave relay mast of 100 foot, well silhouetted on top of a hill in the Saarland in good weather conditions. That pilot, with both his visual report, his in-flight report, and his photography, with one, perhaps, photograph, not 200 or 300 photographs that you might need for Antwerp docks, he could hardly fail to get 100%. His opposite number, with whom he is not directly competing, of course, might go off in another direction to try and find a mortar base plate hidden in the side of a wood in the heavily wooded areas, again, of the Saarland, but in a dip, hardly visible at all in bad weather conditions. He stands a chance of coming back with zero, though he may be just as capable as the man who had the easy target. So that's the first point. And therefore, I don't believe that the Royal Flush of the mid-60s was as anywhere near a yardstick of operational capability as it was from the single base concept in the 50s. But there's worse, much worse. Royal Flush became a new way of life for the squadrons involved. Some would almost completely ignore operational training and devote their whole annual program to the training required to win Royal Flush. That is a desperately bad waste of flying hours, whereas my squadron, for instance, when the weather was bad, would climb above cloud and do combat, because we always knew that combat was a possibility, and in any case, aircraft handling is always a good exercise. We would do cine training for sighting practice. We would do diversions of various sorts for various
purposes.
Cine guns. The gyro gun sight had a camera on the top to record sighting pictures. So in combat or as a specific training exercise, we would try and track each other. Or if we were firing on the flag, of course, for air-to-air gunnery, we would track the flag using the gyro gun sight and the camera above it.
The flag being the toe target.
Yes, but I digress, of course. Yeah. So we would do that sort of thing when the weather was bad, whereas the academic squadrons who were out to win the trophies would either stay on the ground and do ground training or some other form which was conducive to winning the trophies rather than becoming operational. We also did a great deal of air-to-ground gunnery because we knew we could be used in that role, whereas the academic squadrons wouldn't worry quite so much. They do only the very minimum that they required. But there's even worse. Not only did it tempt some squadrons to be less than fully operational, but Royal Flush became a game in an attempt to override the rules and to get one-upmanship on another squadron. It even got to the extent that in-flight frequencies were jammed by opponents, which is, of course, criminal. But it did happen, there's no doubt about it. There's no doubt that when targets were assigned to a particular squadron nearby, and it was generally known that they were going to be in that area, a ground observer would literally telephone through a visual report in case the pilot hadn't got all the details. This is cheating, and no other word for it. There were other means of bucking the rules, which would give a false impression of effectiveness. Of course, there was always the tendency to be less than fully operational when over the targets, going more slowly than you would in a hostile environment. It, of course, increases the amount of time you've got to look at your target. Your photography is perhaps a bit better. You might fly a little bit higher than you would in a hostile environment. You might even go around and do it again because no one's shooting at you in peacetime, and that happened time and time again. Now, the organisers would say that they've covered all these possibilities, and indeed we did have ground observers on some targets, and some competitors were caught, including one of our own squadron commanders with his flap down. And flap down in the Hunter, you know, means that you weren't flying very fast. There were airborne umpires too, and again, a very highly reputable recce pilot was caught by an airborne umpire, but many got away. All this is very bad for operational training and the best use of expensive flying hours, and it did nothing to improve the relationships between squadrons within a nation, let alone between nations themselves. And so, generally speaking, and of course there are some exceptions, I am very much against peacetime academic competitions as a way of measuring operational capability. So you ask me how you would do it then. Well, you do it by what we now call, and it's been going for some time now, tactical evaluations. And perhaps I might dwell on that for a moment, because to my mind, this is the best and really the only generally acceptable means of assessing a squadron or a station's capability. And without going into it in too great a depth, a team of, say, 100 NATO specialists from five or six different nations, but highly qualified in their particular professions, would descend upon a station without any warning, at any time. I don't think they ever came over Christmas, but certainly Sunday night at 9 o'clock would not be unusual, 9 o'clock in the evening, or even at a time when a wing could be expected to be socialising, and that can be embarrassing too. And then they would stay with a pre-planned scenario and academic injects for anything up to 4 or 5 days, testing every conceivable aspect of a station's and a squadron's capability. And this is a very genuine measure of relative measure of capability. And I'll come back to that, if I may, in a moment. But competition I have no time for. I must perhaps add the rider that in certain circumstances, if you are all firing on a flag with a gun for a gunnery trophy, I don't think there are many ways you can cheat on that, and perhaps that's reasonable. But for reconnaissance, I have nothing but contempt for academic competition. And indeed, I can say this ironically because I actually benefited from earlier competitions myself, and indeed one could say that it actually set my career off in doing reasonably well at one of these competitions. But that doesn't change my opinion on them.
Presumably this could have a negative effect, because if enemy intelligence got hold of the syllabus and the victors and the vanquished, if you can call them that, he would have a different assessment of those squadrons' capabilities.
Well, absolutely, but not...
levels of threat.
Well, absolutely, but of course so do our hierarchy.
Yeah.
In peacetime, when one tends to worry a little bit more about your own hierarchy than what the Warsaw Pact gets to hear, and of course they do get to hear very, very quickly the same results. But the hierarchy has this league table of reconnaissance squadrons. You may have your best operational war-fighting squadron right at the bottom of that league.
And so, therefore, that would affect your dispositions in time of war.
Well, it could, I suppose. I think it's all hands to the pump in war. But you may be right, yes.
Anyway...
So if I come back now, having digressed back into that competition business,
yeah.
I've covered my concerns over the hours chase,
yeah.
And I've covered my concern over academic competition. And both these concerns were before me when I commanded 2 Squadron. Otherwise, the task that we carried out are very similar to those that I had and described in my Swift squadron. And I don't think there's anything else I need to say about 2 Squadron, except that because it was the senior squadron, our squadron and I myself led a flypast for Her Majesty the Queen of all the serviceable aeroplanes in Royal Air Force Germany in, I think, June 1964. And again, I was a little unhappy with the staff planning of this exercise, which required me to be over the podium on a certain heading at a precise time. And I was told that if I was more than or less than 3 seconds adrift, I would be in deep trouble. Fortunately, I managed to get over the podium exactly on time and on the right heading, but the Queen was late. And the ground organisation had failed to get her to the podium in time.
Mm. What about flight safety? Did you have many losses in your times there?
No. Accidents? No. And I think this is somewhat surprising because of the nature of the job, which, as I've said several times, is at very low levels, consistent with the rules. And what we're talking about here is 250 feet. And the speeds were normally around 420 to 480 knots in peacetime, of course. And the weather was so appallingly bad, and there was a lot of luck in it. My sister squadron did have 2 or 3, but I don't think that makes them any different from us. There was a degree of luck and, of course, skill in it. But the flight safety rules were stringent. And I think by the mid-60s, we were very much more disciplined than I can claim to have been in the 50s. I don't think anyone would deny that.
Did you ever have to hop out?
No. Until the point we're talking about, I only had one very bad accident in a voodoo in South Carolina.
Or someone else, presumably.
No, I lost all my hydraulics I lost all my utility hydraulic pressures. Fortunately, my wheels were down I could see that my control hydraulic pressures were beginning to waver as well. And I put it down at Navy Beaufort in South Carolina. And unfortunately, the emergency brake bottle didn't work. And the drag chute fell off, and I ended up going off the end of the runway into the swamps at about 100 knots, and the whole thing completely disintegrated, and I just got scratched and bruised. But that was the only bad accident I had. I had a nose wheel up in a Hunter, which was very successfully landed, and I think that was about all I had there.
And I know it's I'd be a bit careful on it, but how many hours did you clock up altogether?
3,700, I think. But I must add that these were almost all fast jet hours. That is short.
A high event density.
That's right, yes. Because transport boys would scoff at that number. But for fighter men who had, and I had my fair share of staff appointments, I suppose that's about right.
What about you? Presumably, had American pilots being posted to you. How did they get on?
Yes, and indeed, I had one of my flight commanders when I commanded 234 at Chivna was an American captain, and he was perhaps the best all-round officer and pilot that I had ever known. He was very, very good indeed. But yes, they did have some excitement acclimatizing themselves to Royal Air Force ways with less strict or less stringent weather limitations and low flying limitations, and a perhaps more dynamic approach to our peacetime training. More flexible approach. I want to be careful what I say here. I don't want to be disparaging in any way. But I think they found it hard work when they came over here. They coped, and I don't know of any that didn't cope, but I fear that your records will show that a large number of them did have accidents here, and most of those were in the low-level roles.
Because I remember reading an article about Red Flag at Nellis,
yes,
when the Buccaneers were over there, and the American reaction to the limits, or rather lack of them, to which the British crews flew.
Yes, there again I must be careful. Perhaps I should leave that until we come on to Red Flag and my involvement in that.
Fine. Yeah.
But we are still talking about the mid-60s at the moment, and I'm really coming to the end of what I might say of any use on 2 Reconnaissance Squadron.
Yeah.
From there, of course, I went to England for the first tour, other than for a short time at Chivna, for the first full tour of my career in Fighter Command as the number 2 in the Fighter Command Tactical Evaluation Team. And I've explained a little bit about Tacaval, but I'll amplify that later if I may. I was coming back to the air defence role, which I left in Germany in a much simplified form, because, of course, we didn't have pilot-interpreted aircraft interception radars in our Hunters. It was eyes, or it was radar-assisted interceptions. Now, of course, we're in a new game at the end of the 60s, when Fighter Command was equipped with Lightnings. I think by then the Javelins were phasing out. I think there were still some in the Far East, but it was a Lightning force and a much upgraded radar chain on the East Coast, giving them the service they needed to intercept the various threats. It was my task to prepare the scenarios, which I referred to earlier, for the noticeable, sometimes we would tell a station, for instance, on its first ever evaluation, we would tell them we were coming, but otherwise we wouldn't. And so it was a shock treatment. But they knew what their scenarios were likely to be because they were so utterly stereotyped. It was a threat coming from the east over the North Sea in various ways, and they had to meet it with their simple resources. Now, I do have a concern here, and I said it at the time, and it was not popular at the time. But with the force I've described, it was not easy to intercept supersonic targets, which might have been the blinders, very low-level targets, or the Badger-Celt combinations and successors thereof, which launched air-to-service missiles from somewhere out. And you had to hit those delivery aeroplanes before they could launch their missiles. Now, the Lightning Force, although it was getting a bit more range out of its newer aeroplanes, was essentially short range. Then, of course, the refueling really got underway, and we were able to extend a little bit further out. The master radar stations, and I fear I can't recall the specific equipments that they'd been upgraded to, were still having difficulties. Typically, they would call weapons bent, or anaprop. Anaprop was a great word, which meant that weather conditions were such they couldn't see at ultra-low level. Consequently, it was difficult to intercept low-level targets. And I have to say that on those three areas, many of the targets which I laid on, physical targets, sometimes I used Lightnings of the Lightning Facilities Squadron as targets against their own peers. And if they came in supersonic, or if they came in very low, or the Canberras came in very low, the chances are they would not have been intercepted. And so I have to say, unfortunately it didn't matter, that there were major shortcomings in our air defence capability of the United Kingdom at the time that I was responsible for evaluating them. Not good news for the units under evaluation, but as far as I was concerned, fact. Now, it seemed to me that one of the answers to these problems was airborne early warning. And I was very surprised that so little progress had been made in generating an airborne early warning force to put what is called a barrier out into the North Sea to give that much extra forewarning. And the air staffs listened to me but were unable to give me any comfort or much comfort. It was thought of and it would come in the end, but we really needed it then. And so as a sort of do-it-yourself exercise between my tactical evaluations and later involved in tactical evaluations, I physically went to the Royal Navy and 849 Gannet Squadron, then stationed at Broady, and persuaded them, and they were looking for a bit of extra work, to come out onto the East Coast for exercises, and I managed to get a name called Shin Guard, I remember, for these exercises, and also to include them in later tactical evaluations when we'd got some basic procedures established to form this first ever airborne early warning barrier out in the North Sea. And thereafter, providing communications remained in and were not jammed, and I did include a bit of basic jamming because I knew the Russians were capable of much more comprehensive jamming, I included basic jamming, which hurt a lot, but nevertheless the idea of early airborne early warning did start to catch on, and we were getting the extra warning of supersonics, of standoff aircraft deliveries and ultra-low level that we dearly needed if we really meant to protect the United Kingdom. I won't go any further into that. Of course, the rest is history. You know that the Shackletons took over the airborne radars from the Gannets, and 8 Squadron performed magnificently for a very long time, but with very antiquated kit. And now, of course, we've got Century and long overdue. But that really was the bulk of my work in the fighter command evaluation team. Not a popular job. I was not greatly popular. It wasn't greatly satisfying. And in 1969, I was promoted to wing commander, sent on a parachute course, and dispatched to be the brigade air support officer down with 16 para brigade at Aldershot.
Yes, that's what I wondered why you trained as a... You were a sort of ground liaison officer with airborne forces, were you?
Yes, I think it was a little bit more than that. But I have said that I was a wing commander, and the primary role in war would be to parachute in with the lead elements, accompanied by either or both squadron leader commanded elements of tactical air support, that is offensive air support, that is fighters, ground attack if you like, reconnaissance, and transport support, which may include helicopters or fixed wing aircraft support. So I had two teams to go with me, and we would parachute in and attempt to organise and control both those elements of air support of the parachute forces ahead. Of course, they were very lightly armoured, and they would need a great deal of this support, both logistically and in firepower terms. And so I would jump in and do that until the hierarchy of number 38 group, which were at Odium at that time, came in on their wheels or by safer and more comfortable means to take over the job I was doing at the start.
How did you find the parachute course? Was it fairly straightforward?
I was over age, overweight and too tall, and it was very painful. It wasn't that frightening, if only because there was no way an airman was going to show that in front of all the soldiers with whom I trained, and I took the standard soldier's course. Yes, it was painful. We did 8 jumps, including full equipment and night, and I continued parachuting on the basis that the paras would only talk to me if I did what they did, and I mean everything. I learned to use their weapons and everything else. and could hopefully have taken charge if I'd needed to as a parachute soldier, but in a very limited way, of course. And I think I did something like 50 jumps
50.
In my time with 16 Parabrigade. Mm.
That would be what, from Hercules, I suppose?
Oh, well, it was from everything. I've jumped out of Andovers, out of Argus's, Hercules, of course, and also a buffalo, which I ran out of the back into the Harz Mountains. And I joined them on many of these very exciting exercises and was able to see what they did on the ground and what they needed. And it was disappointing that they should be so ill-informed at my time of what the Air Force could and could not do. They could not easily understand, if the weather was fine at their location, why aeroplanes couldn't come to them. And I had to explain that the weather was too bad for them to take off at land at their own base, or that they couldn't get through because of weather en route. They found this hard to understand, but they understood it better when they did have it explained. They couldn't understand that they couldn't have an attack force when they wanted it, there and then. Why couldn't we have aeroplanes on cab rank, as we remember them during the war, to be called in at 2 minutes' notice? Well, we didn't have the number of aeroplanes available for that contingency. Now and again, we did do it, but only because we expected an operation to be called within a specific time window. So they didn't like that. They didn't like not having intelligence then and there. They couldn't understand that. What they did value very greatly was the in-flight report, which I've banged on about already to you, and which I so firmly believe in. I did try to speed up the process of photographs, because, of course, as with everyone else, and you yourself, almost fell into the trap today, thinking that reconnaissance is only about, or all and mostly about, photographs. And the brigadier kept saying, "Where are the photographs?" Well, of course, I've explained with great confidence, because I've done the job, that if it's 20 minutes back to our base, I could have photographs from overhead the target in some 30 to 40 minutes. But then I've got to get them to the army in the field. And that was the problem in that particular scenario. So I tried to jack up an interesting little exercise at a place near Hamelin in the Harz Mountains, where I arranged by GPO telephone, because our communications were still very iffy then, I don't know what they're like now, with some of my old friends back on my old squadron at Gutterslow, to do the job, to find us, to take the photographs, to pass the in-flight report, of course, but then when they'd got the photograph developed, have another hunter ready to speed out and back to that location and to drop a parcel of photographs to me from the air brake of the hunter. Now, of course, this is a fudge. You couldn't really do it in war, but we loved this sort of improvisation, and it might have worked had not the brigade headquarters moved 7 minutes after the hunter had passed over and taken its photographs, leaving me to wait for the parcel of photographs and join them at their new location. Of course, by that stage, the photographs were of no import. In any event, as the hunter was taxiing out with the parcel of photographs, literally some 30 minutes after taking them, and was returning to my original location, the pilot carried out his pre-takeoff checks, checked his air brake, and out fell the parcel of photographs on the taxiway. He didn't know about it, took off, overflew me, standing in the middle of a field waiting for this parcel, on my own by now, of course, opened his air brake, nothing came out, and he flew home. And I was left with a great big thinks bubble on what on earth had happened, and it only came out afterwards. But it does underline to you, that silly little story, how difficult it is to get photographs for use in a hostile action, and the value of the in-flight report therefore. And in any case, I was sad that really the photographs, which never ever in my 2.5 years with the brigade were ever used for war fighting, they were only used for the presentations at briefings of the hierarchy.